So overview, and I know since January has started, we have some people who weren't here from the beginning. So this is what we've been doing. We've been working through chapter by chapter this new book that Barry Asmus and I have published called The Poverty of Nations, A Sustainable Solution. That's this book. And so we've gone through the first seven chapters. The overview of the book, if you're just new to the class today or last week when Peter Williams was here, if you're new to the class, the overview of the book is basically it's saying there's only one way for nations to come out of poverty. It's the only way this ever happened in all history. It's the only way that'll ever work or can ever work, and it's for nations to produce more, to make more goods and services, or their factories to produce more, even to build factories so those factories start producing things, and their farms to grow more, and they be more productive. So they're producing their own wealth, because giving food aid and medical aid to people in poor countries, that solves an immediate problem. People are hungry or they're sick, but it doesn't remove the cause. The cause is nations need to produce their own food. So they don't need to depend on food forever from other people. And they need to produce their own medical care and their own doctors and dentists. What will bring that about? That's the question. And so now you should have gotten two outlines today. If you need outlines, hold up your hand. Oh, boy. Rick is handing out outlines. Two outlines. One outline is the lesson for today in chapter 8, but the other outline is what Barry and I have figured out from the Bible and from the history of economic development, 79 things that countries can do. Every single one of those that they do is going to help their economic production. 79 factors in broad areas, what their economic system can do, what their governmental system can do, and then what their beliefs and values can do. And if these things will change, then they'll become more productive. Katrina's got her hand in the air. Keep your hand in the air. Don't just be stubborn about it, and the outlines are coming around. Okay, so here's where we talked about the first seven chapters. We talked about the economic system. We talked about the government. This morning we're going to talk about the freedoms that the system needs to guarantee, and this is going to be a really crucial chapter. I'll get to it in just a minute. Then we'll talk about the values of the system next week. What do people have to believe so that they do support a change in economic policies and a change in government functions? And then we're done with the book as of next week. And then I'm continuing on the big units that we've been doing, and that was a whole overview of Christian ethics. And we got into this because this is the eighth commandment. We were going through the Ten Commandments. This is the eighth commandment, you shall not steal, and it has to do with possessions and property and wealth and poverty and other things. So I'm going to do a couple of more outlines on that. One on work and rest, including what is it right to take vacations? What does God think in the Bible about retirement and how much should we work and how much should we rest? I'm finding a little less of the first and a little more of the second. It happens after a while. But anyway, we'll talk about that. Spending, saving, giving, how this is money concerns for Christians. How much should we do of each? How much should we spend on ourselves? How much should we save? How much should we give away? And I want to try to address that question. That would be February 9th. And then we go on to Commandment 9 in the Ten Commandments, you shall not bear false witness, and I'll talk about why I think it's never right to lie. And then February 23rd, Commandment 10, you shall not covet. So that's the direction we're going with this book. And we have this map of the countries of the world. The green countries are the wealthy countries per capita or per person income above $20,000 per year on average. The U.S. is $50,000 per year. But if you're above 20, you get to be green on the map. All of Canada, the United States, Europe, Australia, Japan, South Korea, those are wealthy countries. Blue is middle income. Mexico, $15,000 per year compared to $50,000 per year for the United States per capita income. Much of Latin America is middle income. Russia, China is about $9,000 per year per capita income. And then the red countries are poor. That would be a country like India, $4,000 per year per capita income. And then the dark red countries would be Pakistan, Afghanistan, much of sub-Saharan Africa, many poor countries. Very few exceptions. South Africa, middle income with 11,000 or 12,000. Botswana now up to about 18,000 per year. So there is some more positive growth in some African countries, but not very many. Okay. But now we're going on to the detailed outline for today. It should say January 19th at the top, Chapter 8, The Freedoms of the System. So now, here's the question. You are a leader or an influencer in a poor country, whether you're a government leader, whether you're a professor or a teacher in a school, whether you're a pastor or a leader in a church, you're saying, I want to help my country. I want to help my country overcome poverty. What will motivate people to begin to work more and produce more? That's what this chapter is about. What will motivate people? And there's one thing that will motivate people more than love for fellow man, more than care for the poor, more than patriotism, more than envy, more than anything else. What will motivate people to work hard and be productive is freedom to work and try different things, and freedom to enjoy the fruit of your labor. So if you work and it succeeds, you get to enjoy what you worked for. That is the freedom that people need so that they can begin to be productive. So that if you have one of these poor countries in sub-Saharan Africa, or even some of these other countries in Latin America, you're saying, no, what will make my country productive? Should we start making plastic things? Should we start making tires? Should we start growing tomatoes or strawberries? What should we do? All of a sudden, if leaders in a country are asking that question, that is totally the wrong question. Stop asking that question. 5-6 people sitting in a room are never going to figure that out. You got 4 million people in your country? Let 4 million people try to figure it out. All you have to do is give them the freedom. And they're all going to be thinking and trying and trying and trying and trying. And maybe only 10,000 of those 4 million are going to figure out something that works, a business that works, a factory that they can start, or a little shop that they can build and grow. Maybe only some people are going to be successful, but some will be successful if they have the freedom and they know the government's not going to take it away from them and their neighbor's not going to steal it from them if they earn the profitability of a new business. So that's the overview. Now we can break down how that works into 21 different freedoms. And that's where we're going today. Now, just where does this fit in the overview of the book? We said economic system has to be a free market. We said the government has to serve the good of the people, not the good of the rulers. And this chapter really could be part of the government too, because we're just saying the economy, the government, and the values, those are the three big categories. But this got to be so long, the government chapter would be so long, we broke it off into a separate chapter and said, these are the freedoms the government has to produce. And some of them overlap a little bit with economics, but there are a lot of other freedoms. So now let's look at this. Chapter 8, The Freedoms of the System, The Importance of Freedom for Economic Growth. Without these economic and political freedoms, no country will be able to move from poverty to prosperity, to increasing prosperity. Once these freedoms are taken away, people won't even try. If they don't have freedom to try a different business, try a different production, try a different activity, they can't try. If they don't have freedom to profit and benefit from it, they won't try. So Adam Smith said in 1776, a really well-known paragraph again, in his book, The Wealth of Nations, that security which the laws in Great Britain give to every man, that he shall enjoy the fruits of his own labor, is alone sufficient to make any country flourish. The natural effort of every individual to better his own condition when allowed to exert itself with freedom and security, that's the key, is so powerful a principle that it is alone and without any assistance capable of carrying on the society to wealth and prosperity. If you've got freedom to try things and work, and then security or freedom to enjoy the fruit of your labor, he said, that'll carry any nation to wealth and prosperity all by itself. Because people will be free to try, and they'll be free to succeed. David Landis, the Harvard economic historian, says, that this remarkable growth and prosperity in 17th to 18th century Britain, it became the most wealthy nation in the world. It was linked to strong freedom and security to enjoy people's fruits of their labor. And so, our country's free. Are they free in government? Are they free in human activity? Are they free in the economic sense? Last week, I mentioned, and Barry Asmus mentioned when he was here with us, this book by the Heritage Foundation, The Index of Economic Freedom. And this Index of Economic Freedom shows a strong correlation between the freedom in a nation and the economic prosperity of that country. That is, the more free countries have much higher per capita income than the less free countries. Stephen, here's a challenge. I have another file on that flash drive, and I just realized that I would love to show how economic freedom affects the prosperity of a nation. If you can see it and get it up, that would be great. You know, I'm going to stop for a minute. Can you turn around? Stephen, can you stand up for a second? Stephen Christie has been doing this for a few years now. I don't know if you know that Stephen has been training to be a firefighter. And he's applying now to be a firefighter out in wilderness areas, like where those firefighters were killed in the tragic fire last year. And so pray for Stephen that he'll be able to get a job and be safe. You find it, Stephen? We'll come back to it. But it says there's a strong correlation between freedom and prosperity. Now, until Stephen finds that, if it's on that disc, there are several arguments from the Bible that support the idea that government should protect human liberty. Is this really an idea from the Bible that we should have liberty? Well, hello, what about the opening statement of the Ten Commandments in Exodus 22? I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. What's slavery? It's the opposite of freedom. God brings them out of the land of slavery. He brings them into a time of freedom. So yeah, that's massive in the history of the Old Testament. God doesn't want his people in slavery. He wants them in freedom. And when there was a loss of freedom in the nation, it was showing God's judgment on the nation. Deuteronomy 28:28-29. If you disobey the Lord, this starts with verse 15, if you will not obey the voice of the Lord your God, or be careful to do all his commandments and his statutes that I command you, then these curses shall come upon you and overtake you. Cursed shall you be in the city. Cursed shall you be in the field. Oh, what will happen? Verse 25, the Lord will cause you to be defeated before your enemies. You will flee seven ways before them. The Lord will strike you with madness and blindness and confusion of mind. You shall not prosper in your ways, and you shall be only oppressed and robbed continually, and there shall be no one to help. And verse 33, a nation that you have not known shall eat of the fruit of your ground and all your labors, and you shall be only oppressed and crushed continually. That's the tragedy if people lose freedom and they're conquered and they're oppressed. That is what I needed, Stephen. Thank you very much. I hope you get a job. Let's see if, now can we go through the other slides on that file? Because there's another one in there that I want to find. Well, we'll do another verse while we're, so loss of freedom was a judgment, but individual liberty and freedom to choose, this is 4C, were prized in the Bible. Deuteronomy 30:19, I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that I have set before you life and death, blessing and curse, therefore choose life that your offspring may live. This is massively important throughout the Bible. God gives people freedom to choose for or against him, and they're responsible for those choices that they make. Deuteronomy 30:19. Joshua 24:15, choose you this day whom you will serve, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. That's inside Margaret's and my wedding rings when we got married, in fact. As for me and my house, it said in my ring, and it said in hers, we will serve the Lord. Choose life. And then Matthew 11:28, Jesus invites people, come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. They have freedom to choose to follow him. He doesn't compel them. In Revelation 22:17, the Spirit and the Bride say, come, and let him who hears say, come, and let him who comes take the water of life without price. The year of Jubilee, still under 4C, this was the time of a great period of blessing from God to the people of Israel, and that was in Leviticus 25:10, what would happen in the year of Jubilee, proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. Liberty is another word for freedom. Proclaim freedom. Freedom. It's a high value in Scripture. Are you with me on this? And sometimes we grow up in a country where we have freedom and we take it for granted. All right, now here is, this is perfect timing. I taught through this book in a one semester class in a week, just a week ago at Phoenix Seminary. And so these were all the maps I was using as I was teaching. Here we go. Five most free countries in Europe, per capita income 46,000. Five least free countries, per capita income 14,000. Five most free countries in Asia Pacific, $40,000. See, that includes South Korea, that includes Japan, includes China at 9,000 also, but South Korea and Japan are up in the mid-30s thousands of per capita income, or maybe higher. What is driving that? It must be Japan, higher than that. And then the Asia Pacific least free countries, 3,400 per capita income. Freedom, that's just economic freedom. That makes a huge difference. Middle East and North Africa, most free, least free countries. On the Americas, most free, least free countries, North and South America. And Sub-Saharan Africa, the most free countries and the least free countries, five of each. So that, thank you, Stephen. Great. Now can I come back to my other presentation? Awesome. Thank you. United States Declaration of Independence. Why have we prospered as a nation so much in the past? Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed not by government, they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. And among these are life, and the next one, liberty. That's another word for freedom. So the nation was founded on a belief that God has given to every person the right to life and the right to freedom. The right to freedom. And that's a huge factor in the blessings that came to the United States over history. U.S. Constitution, one of the most basic purposes of government. Why did they establish the government? There are about five things listed in the preamble to the Constitution, but one is to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our prosperity. Okay, so now what do we mean by freedom? Let's see if we can break it down into more detail. First, the freedom to own property. We talked about that a few weeks ago. Foundational economic freedom. If you don't have freedom to own property, just few... If the communist government doesn't let anybody own property, then there's no freedom. If the few wealthy families in a small country in Latin America, few wealthy families control all the property and nobody can get title to a land to land or a business, there's no freedom. Freedom to own property. We talked about that. I'll skip over that. Freedom to buy and sell. If there's no market so people can buy and sell, there's no production, no economic growth. Number three, here's an important freedom. The freedom to travel and transport goods anywhere within the nation. For people and companies to contribute to a growing economy, they need access to large markets. And in Britain, see, the Industrial Revolution started 1770, about, and they had a huge market for goods because there's Great Britain, and people all through that large country at that time, the roads were open, there weren't any tolls, they had waterways, there was open access to the whole nation, they had the access to this huge market, and the Industrial Revolution brought great prosperity. But compare that to Germany, up until 1834, so 1770, Britain starts to take off, Germany stagnates. Why? Well, one reason was, you grow a crop of beans or potatoes or apples, or I don't know what they were growing in Germany at that time, wheat. And easy, Germany has a lot of rivers, put it on the river, you start to transport it to the market town, but you go a half mile, and there somebody's got a barrier across the river, you've got to pay a toll. You go another mile, somebody's got another barrier, you've got to pay a toll. They had all these tolls. All right, well, I'm not going to go on the river. I'm going to take my potatoes to market on the road. Roads were bumpy, they were crooked, they were uneven. Your crop got damaged. And moreover, then pretty soon the local landowners started putting toll booths on the roads. Stop, pay a toll, stop, pay a toll, stop, pay a toll. How's that going to help? That's not really helping your economy. Because these toll collectors, what are they producing? Nothing. They're not growing potatoes, they're not growing apples or wheat. They're just taking your money. And then the price of potatoes goes up. So Germany was hindered until 1834 when the tolls were abolished. Oh, sadly though, here's the nation of Cameroon, just south of Nigeria here in West Africa. Robert Guest was, a few years ago, the Africa editor of The Economist magazine. And he decided to try an experiment. He went to Cameroon, to the port city of Douala, and Robert Guest decided he was going to see how the delivery system was for beverages in Cameroon. So they were going on a truck to Bertoua, Cameroon, and it was 300 miles away. So if you're driving from Phoenix, where's 300 miles? San Diego, 300 miles. How long does it take to get there? If you're 6 hours. 6 hours. If you're really in a hurry, you might get there faster, but you're risking. Okay, 6 hours. So it should take you 6 hours. Cameroon, they expected, 300 miles is going to take me about 18 hours, day and a half, or a real long one day, okay, driving. Now, what was on this truck? 30,000 bottles of Guinness beer. You got to go 300 miles. How are we going to do? So he's riding along. He's riding shotgun in this beer truck. It didn't take a day and a half or 18 hours. It took 4 days. And when we got there, instead of 30,000 bottles of beer, we only had 20,000 bottles of beer. Why did it take so long? We were stopped 47 times at checkpoints. These usually consisted of a pile of tires or a couple of oil drums in the middle of the road, plus a plank with upturned nails sticking out. And the plank would only be pulled aside when the, quote, policemen on duty were satisfied that the truck had broken no laws and should be allowed to pass. At these checkpoints, they carry out self-appointed safety checks. See if this is work. See, oh, that tire looks a little low. That's $5 fine. Oh, that's a 10 beer bottle fine. Some roadblocks, the police went through our papers word by word in hope of finding an error. Why did this happen? The pithiest explanation why Cameroons put up with all this came from the gendarme at roadblock 31, who invented a new law about carrying passengers in trucks. Against the law to carry a passenger in a truck. When it was put to him that the law he was citing did not exist, he patted his holster and said, "Do you have a gun?" "No, I have a gun, so I know the rules." One stop, they had to wait 25 hours before they could find the guy to give permission to move on. Now, if you're delivering something to San Diego, what would happen? What is it, I-10 or I-8 you take to San Diego? I-8, okay. What would happen if out, you know, about 30 miles outside of Phoenix, some local policeman in a small town decided to put up a checkpoint on I-8 with a plank and nails sticking up through the board, and you had to pay him a fee before you could go on? How long would he last? 10 minutes till, I suppose, the state patrol would come along and whisk him off to jail. But Cameroon is not enforcing the laws. and they're not providing freedom to travel and transport goods within the country. Now, what's the economic result of that? Everybody in Bertula, where they were going, has to pay 50% more for every bottle of beer because they lost all of those goods. So the price of beer is higher. You think it's only beer that it affects? Oh, no. It affects every truck that travels the wrong road. And so every single item that you have to buy in the country costs more because of these foolish tolls. Not only the loss of product, but the fines that have to be paid. And then the higher salary you've got to pay. You've got to pay a guy four days' worth of driving time instead of just one long day. So everybody suffers. And while the driver is sitting at 25 hours at a checkpoint, what's his economic contribution to the nation during those 25 hours? Nothing. He's not growing potatoes. He's not driving a truck. He's not sewing garments in a shop. He's zero productive. And what's the productivity of the guy that's carrying out the inspection and holding a gun there? He is contributing zero to the economy where he should be working and doing something worthwhile. So does it make sense why freedom to travel and transport goods is a basic freedom? That's a basic part of freedom that has to be enforced in a country. Freedom to locate anywhere within the nation. So, I mean, you could say, let's keep sending relief aid to Cameroon. I guess that's needed if people are hungry or they're sick. But hello, government, get your act together. Clear out these roadblocks. Modernized countries did that a couple centuries ago. Freedom to relocate anywhere within the nation. If workers are free to move and take different jobs, then they're not trapped in one place. Contrast Russia in the 16th to 18th century. The workers were fixed to the soil with this feudalistic system of peasants on plantations or large farms, leading to economic disaster. Number five, freedom to trade with other nations. If you have more trading partners, sometimes they can produce things cheaper than you. You can produce things cheaper than them. You specialize, and you by trade, we don't just mean, I trade you a book for another book. We mean buy and sell through trading, through international trade. But Japan didn't do this. Japan had over two centuries of poverty because in 1616, it banned all foreign merchant vessels, except the Chinese vessels. And then 1636, all Japanese ships were confined to Japan. 1637, no Japanese were allowed to leave the country by whatever means, no exit. And what's no more return on penalty of death? That was 1636. Well, the Industrial Revolution takes place 1770 to 1870, and Japan misses the boat. Misses out on all that. And until about 1900, it was just abysmally poor agricultural economy. Why, how did Japan overcome that isolation from trade? Well, 17 British, American, French, and Dutch ships with 305 cannons on board blasted their way into a Japanese harbor in 1864, and then trade resumed. I don't know the details. But anyway, it was open to trade again. So freedom to trade with other nations because it produces economic gain. Now, here's the problem. A country can hinder trade with other countries by making it against the law. No ships can come in here. But you can also hinder trade with other countries by putting a big fee on if somebody wants to export wheat or leather goods or manufactured goods. You say, well, okay, but we're going to charge you another $2 per bushel or $2 per item that you export. All of a sudden, who's going to buy your products? Because there's an export fee. Or you hinder trade coming in by saying, well, we don't want these Chinese manufacturers to compete with us. So every time the Chinese want to import tires into our poor country, we'll put another $20 fee on the tire. So where's the economic productivity of that? Not. It's like the checkpoints. The tariff or the export duty is just charging for something that's not economically productive. The people collecting the fees aren't producing anything. They're just collecting money. Now the government gets it, and so they like tariffs and Paul Collier, this world expert on poverty in poor nations, was director of research for like 20 or so years for the World Bank for economic development in poor countries. He's an Oxford professor. He says, an urgent need is for rich and poor countries to drop the protectionist trade policies. So when you read about that in the paper, and there are these negotiations for free trade agreements, once the free trade agreements, it's just like removing the checkpoints on the roads in Cameroon. But here it's between countries, so the countries can trade freely. And we've got that now with Mexico and Canada, and I think it's a really good deal. Who squawks about that? Yeah, the unions or others within the United States who are trying to protect their own local manufacturing rather than let trade be free and let the prices go down, and then people have to find other things to do. And that's what people complain about. But it's a small group that are trying to be protected. All right, that's freedom to trade. Number six, freedom to start businesses. If you are in a poor country and you're going to say, now, we want to encourage certain kind of organization that will be really helpful to the economic productivity of the country. Let's start a bowling league. No, that's not going to do it. Let's start what other kind of organization? Let's start a school. That long term, that might help. Well, but that's not going to produce things. Let's start a church. Well, a church is a good thing, but that's not going to produce. What kind of organization will produce goods and services more than any other organization at all? It's businesses. Because businesses start making goods that increase the productivity of the nation, and that's how it's going to come out of poverty. So you've got to give people freedom to start a business, because businesses provide the majority of jobs that pay for work and provide the market where goods can be sold. So in a growing economy, the government must make it easy to start and grow a legally documented business. Now, Acemoglu and Robinson, up until this past year when things changed, they noted that the Mexican government protected the telecommunication monopoly of a man named Carlos Slim. Some people thought he was wealthier than Bill Gates, but at least he was up in that category. He had monopoly on telecommunications in Mexico for years and years and years and years and years. And you say, hey, you know, I want to come in and be a Verizon or a AT&T or a Sprint provider in Mexico. You try to get licenses, you're blocked. You try to get permission to start a business, you're blocked. You try to get approval to open your business, you're blocked. And there are all sorts of other barriers that come along. Why? Because this guy is in cahoots with the government and he's running everything. Well, I think just with the new administration in Mexico, I think that is finally declining. But there are other situations where something like this happens. In Peru, page 151, in Peru, this economist, Hernando de Soto, he said, I'm going to try an experiment. Lima, Peru, I've got some research assistants in my university. I think we're going to try setting up a garment workshop on the outskirts of Lima with one employee. And we're going to try to register this business. The research students worked diligently in the government offices. They worked diligently at the registration process for 6 hours a day. It took them only 289 days to get a license for the business. For a one-worker garment factory. Why? Because the people who have the garment factories already are in cahoots with the government, and they're not letting people start a business. But you want to make shirts, you want to make dresses. I mean, a garment, this is a no-brainer, but you can't get a license, so you can't do it legally. So you don't have freedom to start a business. And point D under six, an equally important freedom that government must provide, the liberty to close businesses that are not earning money. Did you see a couple weeks ago in France, there were some Goodyear tire managers in a factory, and they were blocked inside their office by the workers? Did you see that headline? They decided they were going to close this Goodyear tire factory in France, and the workers said, no, you're not going to close it. These two American managers couldn't get out of their office. They had tires piled up in front of the door, and we're not going to let you out until you decide. I don't know what happened, but you don't call that freedom to close a business. Now, you're a corporate head. You're thinking, Should we open a factory in France or not? If it goes bad, we still got to keep paying the workers? Let me tell you, paying people to do nothing when there's no work for them to do is a sure way to bankruptcy for your business. And paying people to do nothing is not going to increase a nation's economic prosperity. So we need freedom to start a business and freedom to close a business. Number 7, freedom from excessive government regulation. Government control of businesses is extremely stifling in planned systems like communist and socialist economies. So, review now. A free market is where people, individual people, decide what is bought and sold and what is produced in the country. A socialist economy is where the government decides what is produced and what can be bought and sold. Now, are any lights going on in your brain?
Yes.
We recently have made a transition in a more socialist direction because the government in the United States is deciding what can be produced, that is, what kind of medical or health insurance can be sold. They've got 4 choices instead of 10,000 different varieties previously. The government is deciding what can be produced, and the government is deciding what can be bought and sold. You have to buy this. It's the law. And you have to offer these. It's the law. That's moving in a socialist direction in a 1/6 of our economy. So a Heritage Foundation study 4 years ago, total cost of government regulation in the U.S. economy was $1.75 trillion in a 15-trillion economy that year. It's over 11% of the economy being devoted to complying with government regulations. I was talking to somebody this last week. He had a friend start to open a shop to sell something in this area, and the guy had months of work and thousands of dollars because a government inspector came in and said, you got to lower this counter, you got to do this thing, you got to meet this government regulation, and filling out the forms and complying with government regulation. How many of you have encountered government regulation that's burdensome in the work that you're in? Lots of you, lots of you, lots of you. Yeah. And Margaret, it hit Margaret and me this last week. We got home Thursday night, we got the mail, we opened the mail, here's a letter from our doctor, who's been a family physician that we love. He's been our doctor for 12 years now that we've lived in Phoenix. Private practice, we know the office manager, we know the nurse, he's got one nurse, got one office manager, announcing to us that he's closing his practice and going to work, and we'd be happy to make an appointment with him where he's working now at Scottsdale Healthcare, which I looked up online. Scottsdale Healthcare has 6,700 employees. Why? Why did we lose the private practice physician on Thursday that we've really enjoyed for years? Now, we're going to still try to go to him. Oh, P.S., it said in the letter, not all of your insurance companies will cover care at Scottsdale Healthcare. If your insurance company does not cover your care at Scottsdale Healthcare, then please contact your insurance company for other options. In other words, find another doctor. That's government control. So it's going to hinder the economy of the United States to a certain extent. And that government regulation is creeping here. But it's something that socialist and poor socialist countries are still at fault into. All right. Oh, boy, freedom from demand for bribes. When Barry and I were in Albania, they said the government officials here do not take bribes. They accept gifts. But if you don't pay, you don't get what you're looking for. And one of the high government officials it was a Christian who was helping us in Albania. He told us the story. He'd bought some property. He was making a fair bit of money on it by Albanian standards. He bought some property outside of Tirana, the capital of Albania. And he decided he was going to try to get a license to build a house on that without paying any bribe. And he'd been waiting over a year, and he couldn't get a license. And he was a high-placed government official. He was a lawyer, and he could not get a license without paying a bribe. Paying a bribe to get a license to operate, paying a bribe to pass the health inspection in your restaurant, paying a bribe to get police and judges to let you off, or to pay a bribe to get the purchasing agent to buy your product instead of a better product from another company. It's an all-pervasive net that drags down the economy and makes everything more expensive. So a bribery system, when it happens in a country, you might bribe a police officer or a judge to impose bogus penalties on a competing company. A salesman might offer a bribe to have the decision-making officer in a company, in another company, buy his company's product. Custom officers might seek bribes before they allow the import or export or shipment of goods. A government inspector might force a factory to stop its production because of some obscure health or safety regulation until they pay a bribe. What happens? This practice places excessive disadvantages on honest businesses that try not to pay bribes. They encourage routine flouting of health and safety regulations because you can bribe the health and safety inspector. So why comply with a health and safety inspection? Just put a little more money in your bribe budget. They discourage product improvement because you know you can bribe the guy in the other company to buy your product even if it's not very good. And so why try to make your country better? Just increase your bribery budget. And all that's harmful economically in a country. Who benefits? Who benefits? The officials who receive the bribes. But they get hurt too, because the price that everybody pays for every product is higher than it would be. So everybody who purchases any product in the country is paying higher prices because a powerful few are gaining benefit while the rest of society loses. The Bible has a lot to say about bribery, and that is on your outline. Point 8D, the Bible condemns bribery. Exodus 23:8, "And you shall take no bribe, for a bribe blinds the clear-sighted and subverts the cause of those who are in the right." It's not a tiny thing. All of a sudden, injustice proliferates in a country. Deuteronomy 6:16-20, "You shall not pervert justice, you shall not show partiality, and you shall not accept a bribe. For a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and subverts the cause of the righteous. Justice, and only justice, you shall follow, that you may live and inherit the land that the Lord your God is giving you." Again and again, a lot of verses in the Bible condemning bribery. The solution is we need people who will hate bribes. Exodus 18:21. "Look for able men from all the people, men who fear God, who are trustworthy, and hate a bribe." How do you come to hate a bribe? When it's offered, you see it, you see accepting it as stealing. And here we are hoping that pastors in poor countries will begin to say, if you're taking a bribe, you are stealing. You're getting money that was not voluntarily offered to you, but it was compelled. And you're getting money that does not belong to you. You're taking it under compulsion from somebody else. And people may be smiling and patting your back, but you're stealing. It is stealing. And if you see it as stealing, then you need to hate a bribe. Proverbs 15:27. "Whoever is greedy for unjust gain troubles his own household, but he who hates bribes will live." Now, what I read is that where bribery is common, the government passes laws. Bribery is against the law. There'll be such and such a penalty. And it just goes on. It goes on and on because everybody's doing it and everybody profits from the little bribe that they're taking locally. And how do they passing a law isn't going to do it. Passing a law is one step. But ultimately, the whole society is going to be changed when thousands and thousands of people in a society every day are turning down bribes and saying, we're not going to work that way. We're not going to do that. Now look, I said something negative about our country right now. I'm very concerned about excessive government regulation. But I want to say something positive about our country right now. The whole culture believes bribery is wrong. Whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, whether you're whatever religious background you come from, there's still a very strong ethos against bribery in our culture. I suppose some of it happens because there are sinful people in every nation. And in companies there are sinful people. And there are payoffs. But unmistakably in our culture, if it is made public, if it is exposed, penalties occur and the person is usually out of a job and often in jail. And so I'm thankful for that, and it's a difference in the beliefs of a nation. People need to realize that bribery is stealing. In general, bribery is far more widespread in economically poor countries like Indonesia. Page 275, we mentioned Indonesia. The Index of Economic Freedom says corruption continues to be persuasive. Corruption and bribery continue to outscore all other factors in the Index of Economic Freedom as worldwide problems. And so this Index of Economic Freedom, Indonesia, what's it say? Freedom from corruption. It scores 30 out of 100. If you got a term paper back and you got 30%, not doing the best. 30% out of 100 on freedom from corruption in Indonesia. And other scores, like limited government, low taxes, low government spending, Indonesia is doing well, but it's falling down on rule of law. In fact, throughout the world, this corruption perceptions index, the darker red countries and the gray countries are the high corruption countries, and look how that overlaps with the poor countries of the world. Corruption perception is people measuring how much bribes are required or accepted in order to take on business in a country. So freedom from bribery is another important freedom. Okay, freedom number 9, for a person to work in any job, no restrictions. I'm going to skip over that. 10, freedom for workers to be rewarded for their work. I'm going to skip over that. We've talked about that. 11, freedom for employers to hire and fire. So you run a restaurant, and in the peak tourist season in the summer, you need 4 cooks and 15 waiters on tables. But in the maybe you're in an area where the winter season is very slow, you only need 1 cook and 3 waiters. You've got to be able to hire and fire people or lay people off. Otherwise, you'll be stuck paying people to do nothing. And that's a sure path to economic stagnation if you start paying people to do nothing. So freedom to hire and fire. But in a country like France, even now, they have rules, very strict rules against firing employees. Very hard to fire anybody. So now you are a business owner, and you know that if you hire someone, and then you get a downturn in your business, you can't fire someone. What's that going to do? Donna? You will not hire. You are very, very reluctant to hire. What did I find out? I just saw this a couple of days ago. Unemployment in France stays at 10% right now. But what age group is hurt the most by unwillingness to hire? Young people. And in France, if you're between 15 and 24 years of age, unemployment is 24%. But this law against firing people, oh, we're going to protect people's jobs. Yeah, nice, if they have jobs. But if they don't have jobs, you're not protecting nothing isn't very useful. So employers have to have freedom to fire. Oh boy, youth unemployment, 15 to 24 age. Youth unemployment in Italy, 35%. In Spain, 53%. In Greece, 55%. High government control countries. And young people growing up with no positive experience or life history of employment and learning how to be a good employee and work at a job in advance and no hope. It's a very deeply troubling situation. Freedom to hire and fire. Point D, 11D, no nation will ever become productive by paying people to do nothing. Number 12, freedom for employers to hire and promote employees based on merit. David Morantz, this anthropologist or sociologist who studied sub-Saharan Africa, nepotism, requiring that you hire your relatives, is so strong in many sub-Saharan African countries, the people involved see nepotism as being more ethical than failing to provide for your family. Well, you got a nephew who is totally useless as an employee, but you're forced to hire him instead of a qualified, skilled person, that's not going to help your economic productivity. But Morantz says in a number of African countries, more often than not, merit is not merely ignored, it is penalized. People who seek the public welfare rather than helping their patrons and clients, their relatives and friends, people who seek the public welfare, the well-being of the company or the nation, they create enemies and they stay poor even when they're occupying very high government positions because they eliminate the possibility of supplementing their low official salary. So freedom to hire and fire. Okay, freedom to utilize energy resources. I'm going to skip that. 13, change and modernize. Number 14, we tell about, well, I'm not going to go into details there. Freedom to, number 15, to access useful knowledge and freedom of information. Okay, printing press invented 1439. 1517, the Reformation starts. 1770, Industrial Revolution starts. 1400s, 1500s, 1700s. 1439, the printing press is invented, not allowed into India until the 1900s. Oh, no, till the 1800s. That whole development of history passed it by. Excluded from Muslim land for many years. And so these discoveries that were happening were passing them by. Freedom to access knowledge and information. 16, freedom for all people to be educated. 17, freedom for women as well as men. And I'll mention that's really important for economic productivity. For girls to be educated, you don't have that in Muslim societies, many of them today. But this has to include letter E, freedom for women to start and own businesses. Like the godly wife in Proverbs 31 who perceives that her merchandise is profitable or who considers a field and buys it, she's engaged in business. Freedom to own property, freedom for women to inherit, to buy and sell, to negotiate contracts, to travel and relocate, to invent and profit, and to get educated and have access to knowledge. That's because men and women are both created in the image of God, Genesis 1, 26 and 27. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. Freedom for all races and national and religious and ethnic backgrounds, number 18. I have to skip over that for time. 19, freedom to move upward in social and economic status. In some countries, you can't get ahead. So look down to point E, subpoint 1 on 19. 80% of America's millionaires are first generation rich. 80% of the millionaires in the United States were not rich growing up. Isn't that amazing? That's freedom to advance in social and economic status. Contrast that with Guatemala. In 1993, Ramiro de Leon Carpio was sworn in as president of Guatemala. And he named somebody as the Minister of Finance, somebody as Minister of Development, high government positions. All three men in 1993 had something in common. All three were direct descendants of Spanish conquistadors, and they were all three members of 22 core families and 26 families. They were all three members of 48 core families who have controlled economic and political power in Guatemala since 1531. If you're in one of these 48 families, you have the power, the prestige, you have access, you have ability to advance economically and socially and develop wealth. So 1531 to 1993, how long is that? That's 460 years. Those families have controlled Guatemala. It's not the case in Guatemala that 80% of millionaires are first generation rich. Concentration of hands, this is point D, concentration of wealth in the hands of a few privileged and powerful families stifles economic growth because there's no opportunity to advance. All right, 20, freedom to become wealthy by legal means. This is really important in a society. Point C, nothing motivates a person as well as self-interest. the hope of earning more and bettering his own condition. People must be able to see that a measure of financial success is possible. But if a society, point F, focuses on envy or hatred of the rich, it significantly hinders economic productivity. I'm just going to mention this. If you are in a poor country and you look around and you see, you know, 15 years ago, your cousin started a grocery business in downtown capital city, and all of a sudden he's wealthy today, what does that make you think? Maybe I could do that too. If you see your cousin or your neighbor or your nephew that started out poor and he became rich, you think, wow, there's opportunity here. But if you never see anybody ever able to become rich, it's a huge hindrance to economic productivity. So a country has to allow people to prosper and grow and become wealthy. Joyce, I'm looking at you. Glenn grew up poor, didn't he? Yes. Well, not wealthy. Not wealthy. No. No. All right. So, and we can look around us and we can see people who have done well and they've grown up poor. Okay. So what motivates a country? You see why freedom is important? That's the point. All these different freedoms, they're crucial for an economic development in a country. And when a government tries to clamp down and exclude those freedoms or doesn't protect them, it's going to trap itself in poverty. We've got 4 minutes to do questions or comments or objections. I don't know your name here in the front. I've met you, but I think I have. But okay, hold on just a second. There's a microphone coming. What's your name?
Drew Clark.
Drew.
In item B4, you indicated the importance of the freedom to relocate anywhere within the nation.
Yep.
How do you distinguish them between the freedom to relocate across national boundaries?
Oh, well, that's also important. There's a section in there on freedom for people from all, I think from national backgrounds and racial and ethnic backgrounds. And the United States grew immensely through immigration. But it was controlled immigration, so we knew who was coming in, but there were huge, I mean, it's open doors with, but you register and you know who's coming. So that's how my grandparents got here. So because that always brings a wealth of talent from outside the country too, so also important. Yeah, what else? What else? What else? I forgot your name.
Marilyn.
Oh yeah, David Marilyn.
Any comment on the EPA regulation in the coal industry?
Horribly destructive. Because a third of our energy, something like that, is produced by coal. If you take that away, what happens to electric prices? Go up. Yeah, okay, wind and solar, 4 times or 10 times more expensive without subsidies. Who does that hurt the most? When electric prices go up, who can't afford it? The poor, the unemployed, the low-income people in society. Foolish government regulation based on a mistaken belief in global warming, which isn't the way God set up the world to work. I mean, human-caused global warming. Okay. Yeah, thanks. You're getting the point, the freedom needed. Okay. Jack?
I saw somewhere that within the green countries, the United States ranking is dropping.
Oh, yeah.
Would
yeah.
you care to relate on that?
Yeah. Oh, I brought this and forgot it. Thank you. Monday, editorial Wall Street Journal by Terry Miller, who produces this economic index of economic freedom. And Barry and I met him in his office at the Heritage Foundation a couple months ago. Terry Miller, writing the Wall Street Journal, says, "World economic freedom has reached record levels. It's increasing for many countries of the world. But after 7 straight years of decline, the United States has dropped out of the top 10 most economically free countries. The U.S. is losing ground. We're down to number 12 of the countries of the world in economic freedom. Why? Higher tax rates, runaway government spending, national debt, regulation including healthcare, finance, and energy. Impedes personal freedom and national prosperity." That's Wall Street Journal this past Monday. We're going backwards. Very concerned.
We can change that, right?
Well, we have the freedom to vote. and to speak. Yeah. Yeah. Last one. Is there one more? I've got a minute left on the clock. Freedom. All right, Jack.
On one of your charts, it said Malthusian trap. Would you care to tell us what that is?
The what now?
Malthusian trap.
Malthusian trap. Malthus was an economist in England who said the world's running out of food. People are growing too many people, not enough food. That was in the 1800s, I believe. And it didn't happen because everybody comes. We're more people, but we're more productive. So don't fall into that. That's the fixed pie mistake. Pie expands. There's more for everybody. All right. Well, freedom. A big deal. A very big deal. Next week, we go on to talk about if the changes are going to come about in the economy, changes are going to come about in the government, the only way it's going to happen is if people believe these things are important. So we're going to go through like quick overview of 35 values. I'll just do some highlights of things that it's important for pastors, missionaries, teachers, professors, and even government leaders to teach people in a country to believe so that these things will more and more be likely to change in a country. Okay. Our Father, we thank you that you have created us with the ability to choose right and wrong, good and evil. And you have, we believe, given the blessing of freedom to us as people that you want to have protected by our governments. We pray for our nation, Lord, that the eyes of the leaders of this nation and the eyes of those who influence opinion in this nation and the eyes of the people as a whole will be opened once again to treasure freedom much more highly. And for these poor nations, Lord, where bribery is so common, where checkpoints are on the roads, where commerce and innovation are hindered, where people can't enter businesses and industries, where the government just oppresses, 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 we pray, Lord, that you would set them free from that oppression. Lord, we see the enemy's hand ultimately behind this, hindering and damaging and harming and trapping in poverty and misery men and women created in your image. Lord, we ask that you would work in these countries to set them free from this oppression and let the kingdom of God, Lord, your work, advance powerfully through the power of your word throughout these countries, even to change these systems so that freedom would be increased. In Jesus' name. Amen.